Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
I'm actually feeling really bright today and like happy and
excited.
Well,
you're wearing an orange sweater as well. That's very
I know.
Bright.
I used to be told actually that orange is like the most positive colour, and if you're feeling like not in a very good mood, you just wear orange.
Orange is the new black.
Orange is just going to change the world. So our guest today is one of the world's leading gallerists.
Yes.
And somebody that has been a big inspiration to me. I don't know if she knows that, but she has been. And I used to go to her gallery a lot when I was first getting into the art world, and used to hold the invitations. These have these incredible designed invitations by Faro Design, which actually the artist for each show would choose the colour on. And I just loved the experience of going to her different galleries and throughout London, and she's since become one of the world's leading galleries and has a presence literally in countries all over the world with her artists in museums and different places.
Yes. We are incredibly privileged to have with us today
Sadie Coles.
Thank you.
That's your intro. How are you, Sadie?
I'm good.
Good. Well, it's a total pleasure to have you here. We are just so influenced by what you've done in the art world. Mainly I'm influenced because you worked at the National Theatre for a while.
which apparently
you hated.
In the press office, yeah. I was half with Peter Hall and then half with Richard Eyre. So I had 6 months of both.
It was wow.
And I was doing, in the marketing department, we were doing the posters. So that was kind of interesting. It was great.
Is that because of your art history studying?
No, I just needed a job.
Right.
So that was my sort of first job. And then after a year of doing it, or 9 months or something, I was like, oh my God, I can't stand these actors anymore.
Oh, right, nice. that's to hear.
And actually, but my mum was an actress, so I kind of...
Was she a theatre actress?
Yeah. So then I decided that I should use my degree. So I looked around for a job, and the only job I could find was in Bristol at the Arnolfini. So I took that job and started that. That's where my art career started.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
So how long were you there?
I was there for...
What is the Arnolfini?
The Arnolfini is like the ICA. It has no collection, but it does temporary exhibitions, and it's right in the middle of Bristol on the canal side. And Bristol at that time was kind of really fun. There was still a lot of massive attack.
Of course.
You know, all of that
and
whole
Tricky
scene.
Tricky was there, wasn't he?
Yes.
Gold Trap, even, I think.
It was kind of fun. And my boss was this legend called Barry Barker. And Barry was quite hands-off. So within, about 6 months of working there, he made me assistant director. And then I started to do shows.
Yeah.
And one of the first shows I did was with Richard Long, and Richard was represented by, Richard lived in Bristol, but he was represented by Anthony Doffey, who at that time was like the most important European contemporary art dealer. And Anthony came to the opening and said, could you come and see me in London tomorrow? And I thought I was going to get told off.
The way you put it together.
Yeah, something about the show. Yeah. And he said, would you like a job? And I was so desperate to get back to London. I took the job without really realising the difference between public and private.
Right.
Like, you know.
Sales.
Yeah. But I took to it like a duck to water.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
And never looked back, I think.
Yeah. Well, so you were there, and then in 2007, you asked Anthony if you could do your own sort of spin-off for younger artists.
Oh, no, that, I think not that was 2000. When was
1997.
No,
sorry, yes.
Yeah.
No, 1995. No, it was 1995.
Right.
Because I left in 96. Because once I started doing... Because at Anthony's, I did exhibitions and artists. And I worked a lot with American artists.
Yeah.
And... but Anthony got this tiny little garage space, and I said, could I do projects with younger artists?
Emerging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did about 9 of them, and then I realised, actually, this is kind of fun.
Yeah.
And doing my own program it really appealed to me. And so I left, and that was in 96. And then I went...
Was he upset?
Yeah.
Was he?
I think so.
Really?
But it was a wonderful place to work because there were so many wonderful, incredible artists in that gallery. And there were also some fantastic colleagues, all of whom went on to open their own galleries, like Lorcan.
I was going to say Lorcan O'Neill in Rome.
Was she working alongside Lorcan O'Neill?
Yeah, we were very close. We were still very close. But he was great. He did mostly the German artists, and I did mostly the Americans. So it was kind of this funny sort of... He was also, there was also Robin Vowsden and Matthew Marks had been there just before me. I never worked alongside him, but...
wow, what a pedigree. So
he really Tanya Banakdar.
Really?
There was loads of us. I mean, practically everyone who worked there went on to...
But back then it was like Listen Gallery and him, but there wasn't really any other galleries that were like leading in that sense.
There weren't. I mean, Maureen was there.
Oh, yeah, of course, Maureen.
And she,
yes.
You know, she's... And Matt's gallery, they were the two sort of really important. And Carsten Schubert, of course, who then... they were really strong, actually. Mm. But it was an incredible time. It was so tiny, the art world then. It was sort of cute. Anyway, and then I went to work for Jeff Koons, and then I...
As a gallery assistant? As a studio assistant?
As a studio manager.
Wow. Did you really? I never knew that.
Yeah, which was really fun.
That's so cool.
In Los Angeles?
In New York.
Wow.
That was really fun. But I was quite homesick, if I'm completely honest, for trees.
Yes.
Yeah,
and for Sundays. Have you noticed when you're in New York that no one really does Sundays? No one lies around the sofa on a Sunday. You like go to the gym and then you have brunch and then you go to a museum.
Keep it moving. Absolutely.
Or they just work every day of the week. I mean, I was talking to an actor the other day who just said that like there is no holidays in America.
Yeah.
And he was really missing being in England because he forgot that Americans don't really take time off.
You know, that loafing around on a Sunday, reading the paper, then going to the pub and having lunch with your friends,
and then
maybe going for a walk.
Doesn't exist.
It's sort of, so I was homesick for that. But also, a lot of my friends who'd been artists who'd been watching me at Dofe's and when I left were expecting me to open a gallery and were quite surprised, actually, when I went to New York.
How long was you there for?
I was there for about... 6 months, 9 months, something like that.
Right.
And then Sarah Lucas rang up and said, listen, if you don't come back, I'm going to have to sign with White Cube.
Oh, wow.
And John Curran was sort of saying, you know, like, come on, open a gallery in London. So
how did you meet John Curran?
Well, I just from sort of being around, because I used to go to New York once a month, and I guess you just gravitate to your own generation. So I just kind of knew everybody. John, I think I actually met in Venice in the Biennale. There was a great Biennale where I can't remember who was the director, but I think it it wasn't Francesco Bonomi, it was before that. But it was when the Arsenale was given to 10 different curators.
Oh, yeah.
When was that? 1993?
Right.
Wow. I can't remember, around then. And John Curran was in Francesco Bonomi's section, I think. And I met him then.
Wow.
Yeah. And we just became friends. And I knew Andrea Rosen really well. So.
And he was already signed with her.
Yeah, he was working with her. So I just knew a lot of people.
Wow.
And honestly, there was so little competition for artists at that time. If you were opening a gallery in London, you could sort of sign up anyone.
Really?
Pretty much.
And also, I guess, like, it was a time when Sarah Lucas and John were in a way, at the beginning of their careers. You know, it wasn't like they are now, where they're kind of globally recognised and in museums and all that stuff. So you were kind of
exactly
at the same point as them.
Yeah.
You were growing with them. It's just, it was quite a magical time.
I wasn't
there, obviously, at that time, but it's probably kind of like the dream.
Probably being assigned the American artist kind of changed your affinity with, like, because if you hadn't done that at the gallery, if you'd maybe been assigned German artists, you might have gone a different route, potentially.
Yeah, absolutely, maybe, absolutely. I would, and the thing is, when I opened the gallery, I definitely, it was right at the YBA moment.
Of course.
In 97, and it was very clear to me that I didn't want to be a British gallery.
Yeah.
I wanted to have an international gallery, just because I had been traveling a lot for Dofay, so I kind of wanted to keep that going, and so for a long time I had very, very few British artists. Actually, I had a lot of American and German artists, to be honest. So that was kind of
is that the HQ? Because that's very
the HQ
headquarters.
The HQ headquarters. That was really because when I opened, I had two shows at the same time. One was in the tiny space on Heddon Street, which was the first gallery.
Yeah.
And the other show, which opened also at the same... Actually, maybe it even opened just before, was Sarah Lucas's show, which was a pop-up, really, in a warehouse space off Clerkenwell Road at St John's Lofts. And I always wanted the HQ to signify that we could do things in all sorts of different spaces. So I've always done kind of pop-ups or gallery swaps or changed my address a lot. So that was the idea. And also my dad was a naval officer. So I like the kind of military thing.
A little
thing.
Nod to that.
That's cool.
Yeah. Are you really happy in your space now? Because this has been...
Yes, but I've got two right now. I've got one on the posh one, I call it, the grown-up one, on just off Berkeley Square. And then I have the big one, which is just off Kingly Street on the wrong side of Regent Street, which
I love, though. And it used to be the Valbonds nightclub, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
And it's huge. It's like 6,000 square foot.
Yeah, that's a really great sort of secret space that when you go upstairs, it's got a sort of good oh wow factor.
Yeah,
it's unexpected. But that will probably eventually have to be developed by the Crown Estate, who are my landlord, so we will go at some point. But I like that.
I was going to say,
The artists like having a new challenge, because most artists, once they've done a show once, twice, three times in a space, they get kind of bored. So the artists like me moving. The collectors don't, because they get confused about where I am.
And what about your staff?
They like it.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculously expensive to do it, but I like it.
Good.
I think I found that with Carl as well, because this will be our third space now, the one we're doing in Margate, and it feels like it's a new job all the time.
Yeah.
So like when I first worked for him, I was in the tiny gallery in Shoreditch, then we moved across to the bigger gallery, and it sort of gives you, as a member of staff, like a kind of new,
research,
feels like you're getting a new job, basically.
Yeah.
And it, in a way it helps, because even though collectors don't know where you are or whatever, I think it helps invigorate them, even if they don't realise straight away.
Exactly.
But it does keep it exciting.
Yeah. I mean, I would always stay in the centre. I'm a real West End girl.
Yeah.
And would you ever want
to... So Margate's not on the cards for you?
No.
Would you ever open it in another country?
Well, never say never, because who knows what with Brexit. In fact, I did look at another European possibility, just because I was a bit kind of... That was about a year ago. I was like, oh my God. I love London. I love it. So I'm hoping that whatever happens, that we can sort of... make an opportunity of it and rethink in some way. But, I'm also very, very interested in Asia, because when you go there, it just feels like super optimistic and full of possibilities.
Yes.
And it's a very young environment to be in. But I don't really, I have no intention of having bricks and mortars a situation in Hong Kong or mainland China, because I don't want to have that kind of financial risk, really, because then I think you start programming your gallery in a different way making sales in a different way. And I'm also
you've never felt compromised by
estate? Absolutely not.
Wow.
No, and I'm also a very, very hands-on person. You could say control freak. Yeah. So I like that feeling that artists can call the gallery and actually speak to me, and the same with the clients.
Well, I was going to ask you.
I don't want to have something that then gets too far away from me.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But I wonder if that's why galleries like Maureen's and yourself, they do still feel very personal. And even though you might have a very big artist roster, it all feels like genuine, and it feels like they probably can call you. I was going to find out that, because when artists become really successful, like you've worked with Richard Prince, Matthew Barney, you know, Sarah, these like giants in a way of contemporary art, like how does it change from the early days when they're young and then suddenly they become these big stars? Is it harder to manage that? Like how does it, and with auctions suddenly happening and it all sort of changes, doesn't it? It becomes a very different thing.
I mean, it can sometimes be super scary, because what was manageable there's suddenly a lot of other interests that can distract, actually, to be honest. And obviously, when an artist becomes super, super successful, it attracts the competition, to say the least.
Mm. Oh, of course,
not just other dealers, but the auction houses suddenly want lots, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
So that can get quite intense. And for an artist, that of course can be incredibly exciting, but it can also be very distracting or very unnerving, you know. There are quite a few of my artists who are very unnerved by high prices or sudden price things. And in a way that can also to use a weird word, constipate them. Do you know what I mean? It's if I make this, how much is it going to sell for, and who's going to buy it? You know, it can get a bit like that.
It's almost like a paralysis or something.
That can be weird. But other artists all artists are different. You really can't generalize, and some of them get incredibly excited by all of that stuff. And
but you have such a responsibility to manage that, because I guess that is such a, as you're saying, it's scary, because one wrong move or something, you could really, if you overprice them, or I mean how do you cope, say, when an artist's secondary prices are so much higher than the primary prices?
Well, you have to adjust, you have to watch that, you have to keep an eye on it, because if you don't, the artist could say you're underselling my work.
Mm.
So you have to balance it, and you know, you can apply a mathematical theory to that, which is, you know, like a few years ago it used to be that the secondary market should be about 30% higher than the primary.
Got it.
But I would say that's kind of gone out the window in the last 5 years. Mainly because those secondary prices can fluctuate so much.
Well, we've seen that, haven't we? Yeah. We've seen so much, especially like 2 or 3 years ago, there was such a surge of art that was selling like secondary ridiculous.
And then
now,
suddenly,
completely plummeted.
Yeah.
And if you've, as the gallery, set that price at the secondary price, you just can't sell any work at all. And you can't lower prices, can you?
Well, there are all sorts of strategies. In a way, what you have to do is listen. You have to get a real sense of what do I think the market will be happy with, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So you try and listen to all of the signs, conversations, auction price records, primary records, what other artists of a similar type, you know, you have to kind of make those kinds of calls, those judgments, and hopefully get it right. You can't lower prices, but there are strategies that, you know, you can encourage an artist to make a different kind of work, or think about a different scale, or you know, you can reposition someone too,
really,
a little bit by showing the work in a different context, or you know, it's kind of interesting.
Do you enjoy that tactical side of it?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah,
I think about that all the time, and I do think very long term about these things. You know, I feel that you know, you're on a long journey with someone.
Mm-hmm.
And although I have worked with artists of all different ages, you know, you can see people, you know, there are ups and downs in many careers in a long term, you know, so people can hit heights at different moments.
Yeah.
And that, you know, having worked at Dofe's also with artists of a much older generation, that one saw that, you know, that there was that there might be a sort of dip in the,
have you got any examples,
middle age period of an artist, and then things step up again.
Like, who would that be?
Well, I don't want to say that.
Oh, okay.
Indiscreet.
Well, if they've stepped up again, that's a positive spin, isn't it?
Or died.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, I see, right. Right.
But, you know, it does happen. So, you know, I think, honestly, at the end of the day, if an artist is really, really good,
yeah,
and has the appropriate
skill set,
but also the appropriate and good museum interest, yes, representation, publication, mm-hmm, platform, you know, that it will happen. Mm. You know, people will get.
And so when you take an artist on, you're basically committing to them for life, aren't you, for their career?
Yes, it's like getting married.
Wow. Do you go to like the school shows if you're trying? Do you go like actively looking for an emerging artist, or do you listen to your artists? And
I do try and see some shows.
Yeah.
I don't see them all. I would love to see them all, but often they're in peak art fair time or Venice time.
It can be so hard to see everything anyway. Yeah, and I sometimes feel it's just distracting them.
If I can, I do. But I would say that I don't pretty much. I have never taken, I think, anyone from a degree show because I actually think that artists need to have 2 or 3 years after their art school moment to just really have to be an artist and not be anything else, because those are the artists you want,
mm-hmm,
you know. And it does take a while to really commit to what you're doing, I think,
mm-hmm,
and so I can see someone at a degree show and be interested, and then watch them go through their group shows, maybe show with other galleries, you know, just keep an eye on someone, and then you leap on. Often, actually, I have bought a person's work before I,
to show commitment, to show like,
no, I'm just curious, I like it, like I collect myself, and I have two collections. One is the work of the artist that I represent,
mm-hmm,
and the other collection is younger artists who I just enjoy collecting. But often that collection, for instance, I usually buy one thing from every art fair from a younger gallery, and that collection often then leads me to have something around that just, I think, I really like that.
Yeah. Mm.
That is actually good. And then maybe I will.
And you try and live with them then?
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Did you have an interest in collecting from a young age of other things? Or like, how did you first get into art? Do you remember? Or?
Yeah, I mean, this is a story I've told before, so it's possibly boring. But
my
mother, who, as I said, was quite a creative, artistic person, would drag her three kids to museum shows and theatre and opera and contemporary dance and God knows what else. And I had two kind of epiphany moments. One was going to the Tutankhamun exhibition at the British Museum when I was like 6 years old.
Wow.
And I remember queuing up for 6 hours because those days you didn't have internet pre-booking. You had to actually queue.
Queue, yeah.
Dark ages.
And we queued for about 6 hours. And
we were
kids. My mum was trying to keep us all happy. And then we went down, you went to the entrance. They built the entrance so that it replicated going into the tomb. So you went down this dark tunnel, and right at the end, there was a spotlight on the lapis lazuli face,
wow,
you know, the Tutankhamun's lapis lazuli bust thingy.
Wow.
And I just kind of thought, like, oh, my God. And I think for me, that was a sort of I just had this feeling about objects and their power and beauty and blah. So there was that. And then the other thing was that we lived in Edinburgh for a year when my dad was at a naval base up there. And my mum took took us, and I think it was my birthday treat, and I was 7, to see Lindsay Kemp.
Really?
Just a little bit.
No, but Lindsay Kemp's so great.
Yeah.
And he really helped Kate Bush.
Yeah, and David Bowie.
And David Bowie, exactly.
I don't know who Lindsay Kemp is.
He was a mime artist. And it was quite out there and sort of super gender bender 70s weird, you know.
I remember thinking
like, what the? But that was quite interesting because I remember thinking that that was really something. So those two things.
At 7 years old you saw that and that stuck with you. Yeah. Wow.
And then I guess when I was like 13, 14, I was really into feminism, like all 13, 14 year old girls. And I went to see a Nancy Grossman show.
Oh, really?
I don't know if you know, she did these leather sex mask.
Yeah, totally.
And I just thought that was, it was the time of punk as well, so that it just all felt all right.
Wow.
So then I got really into contemporary art at that point.
Cool.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
There was a really great article years ago that Alice Rawthorne wrote about leading gallerists who were female. And it was talking about the idea that you might have all these FTSE 100 companies that don't have women at the top of them. And even in the art world, you know, often women artists' prices aren't as high as men at auction and things like that. But gallerists have often been able to succeed as women. And I did a list the other week before we met Louisa Buck of people that had inspired me and been welcoming to me in the art world. And every single one of them was women. There was like 35 people on it and every single one was a woman. And I was like, I was really wanted to find out from you how it's changed and also why you think it was possible for you to succeed in the way that you have globally as a woman. Because in other industries, it's never been that kind of equal somehow.
Yeah, actually, I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I think originally, you know, I always felt like, who put you in charge? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
about patriarchal crap. And I always kind of, I mean, it's probably to do with my relationship with my dad. I always resent male authority. I just don't like it. So in a way, I kind of... in the early part of my career, I just ignored any feeling of inequality. I just ignored it. And if people asked me back then, I would just say, I don't know what you're talking about.
Cool.
You know, I'm not having a problem because I was just doing it.
Yeah.
But now I feel, I'm, you know, I think that the whole Me Too, not surprised, all of those things have maybe made me re-examine how I feel about it. And, I think, you know, I think you just have to push hard every day, actually. I do think that that women in the art world, that whole question, I think women are very good colleagues, actually. And so a lot of the art dealers that I have very good relationships with good working relationships with are women, actually. Like, I miss Andrea Rosen, actually, now she's closed.
Yes.
You know, I work a lot with Barbara Gladstone and, you know, I mean, I have lots of other female gallerists who I think are really, really good colleagues. But I don't think there's any... it's like I always resent that idea that women make good gallerists because they're nurturers. I mean, fuck that, quite honestly. I just want to be equal, for what I feel about it. I do think there is something, though, about rich white men wanting to spend their money with white men.
Right.
There is something about that.
Yes.
Which I think informs the inequality of prices.
Totally, yeah.
And that I resent, and I just feel eventually that that will level out,
yeah.
But possibly not in my lifetime. But I do think that we are making gains one way or another.
Yes.
And, you know, that's a good thing.
The other thing I think is quite rare about you as a gallerist is how supportive you are of other galleries. Because when I first came into the art world, I only got into contemporary art, the actual art world, in early 2000s. But I always found it very competitive at that point. And by 2006 or something, or seven, before I was even working at Carl's, it began to feel very like dog-eat-dog. People weren't talking to each other. And even if I was buying an artwork from a gallery, a different gallery, some of the people who were selling, if I was buying something from another gallery, they'd tell me off for like supporting that gallery. It felt very unsupportive. Whereas I felt like the moment I met you about 8 years ago, I think at Lister Basel, you were just so kind and kind of calm and just very open. And I actually found that quite rare. But I think through you having been that collegiate and even that lunch we had, you know, in the summer, I know it sounds silly, but like, yeah. And also I know that you work with Art Basel.
What was
you
the
know,
lunch? Now the lunch was...
It was lots of different galleries Sadie invited for us all to go and have lunch. And I got there and it was just like all our colleagues. It was just the nicest thing. And it felt really like important though, because we don't all see each other in that way. So is that an important thing that you actually constantly think about?
I think it's really important. And I think London is very rare in that it actually is super collegial. And that I did that lunch to kind of celebrate that really.
Yes.
Because actually, you know, New York feels a lot more dog-eat-dog to me.
Definitely.
And that, even though I have some great colleagues there.
Same, yeah.
But I do think that there is a really, really good community here from the top to the bottom and, or the young to the old, and that should be recognised. And the other thing is that I really think that sharing information is essential for galleries. Like, you know, all sorts of information, like, you know, who's a good collector, who doesn't pay.
Yes.
So basically that lunch was a huge gossip fest.
Right,
stuff
right,
like that.
Right, yeah.
You know,
so do you have a naughty list in the gallery?
We all have a naughty list.
Do you really?
Yes, of course.
Have you got a naughty
list?
Yeah,
big time. You're on it, babe.
No, you're on the good list.
Oh, thanks.
But it is interesting. You know, then you also share information about, I don't know, Brexit fears, import, export, tax inflation.
What are your Brexit fears?
That importing and exporting art will become more complicated,
yeah,
or less complicated, or that we'll become a sort of rogue tax-free state.
Mm. Yeah. Well, no one knows. I mean, I'm still trying to understand it.
And so, yeah, talking about sharing those sorts of information, staffing information, you know, what should you be paying your gallery assistants? All those, you know, it's really important that we all talk to each other.
Totally,
It was really, really fun.
It was also very impressive.
I'm definitely going to do it again.
You know, I was sat there thinking, like, all the amazing galleries in Glasgow. You know, there were people from all over the UK.
Oh, so people travelled down. Oh,
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it actually, I felt incredible pride at the end of it. I was like, how good is the British art world, though? And even if we want to be international, which we all are now, because a lot of our collectors are all over the world, there is something really special about the British art world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful for you for that, because I think it's so, like, that's my whole thing is about being inclusive, which is also partly why we're even doing this podcast, was just about opening the door a bit, because people feel so like the art world's elitist or it's a hidden thing and they can't be part of it. But I feel so strongly the reason I'm into art is that it changed my life and improved my life. And I was just impressed in a way that you as a leading figure, because I didn't know you, I just knew the openings with, like, you know, so many
people.
Well,
the name, the brand
in a way. Well, it is a brand, isn't it, in a way? But it was just a really refreshing thing, and it kind of made me want to continue doing what, you know, how I was, you know what I mean? Just be myself, and you can be a good person and be a gallerist, and you don't have to, you know.
Well, I think what we do is you know, I mean, if I'm being trite about it, I would say we're just shopkeepers, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But on the other hand, what's in the shop is magic.
Yes.
You know, we're selling luxury goods, of course, but art is a necessary art of all sorts, you know, theatre, language, everything. You know, it's an essential thing. Human beings need to articulate their feelings about the world, and they do it through culture.
Mm.
And so for me, I think it's sort of magic what we do.
And on that note, we ask every guest that comes on the show, what is a touchstone artwork for you? Like, if you could go to a museum and take it home with you and do an art heist, even if you don't want to break the law, but what would you take home if you could?
It's probably been the same thing for the last 30 years. It would be Gilbert and George doing the singing sculpture.
Oh, really?
Underneath the arches.
Yeah.
In front of me on their little table, plinth with the metallic makeup and their rubber gloves.
Underneath
the arches. It's actually, I find it so moving, that piece, actually. Yeah. Melancholic. It's super British. It could only be England.
Yes.
I mean, I think it's magical. And I think they're magical.
Yeah, they are.
And also, I like things, I always like things that are brave. There's pretty much no one braver than Gilbert and George.
That's true.
Or Jeff's puppy.
Oh, yeah, the Jeff Koons
like the
puppy.
Big, big one, the massive, Yeah,
but that's personal because I was sort of involved in the fabrication of that at the time in 97. So that would be kind of...
And what came first, the vase edition of the puppy or the big the flower puppy?
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah, that was made for Arrelson for this... a group exhibition in, was it Austria? I can't remember where Arrelson was. Anyway, it was in front of a chateau. It was amazing.
Wow.
I had such a powerful experience with his work. Because in the mid-2000s, he was so huge. Mm. And it was almost like I just wasn't looking at his work. Because by then, it was just like huge, huge. And it was almost like Damien Hirst. I just didn't really look at them. But I went to the show during Basel, Art Basel, one year at Foundation Biola, in that incredible, bit outside Basel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just exquisite. And I had no idea the power of those objects. And I suddenly realised that he was a total genius.
Mm.
And even the book they made with that show, it just left this thing. And I respect him so much. I mean, it's quite genius, a lot of his work.
Yeah.
I mean, really radically genius, actually. Yeah. And fun as well. Yeah, and joyous and celebration
bonkers.
Of life.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
But in a way, it's about what art can do, which is transform.
Precisely.
And elevate.
Precisely.
You know, so it goes from low to high.
Yeah.
Or
he moved low culture up to high culture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I guess I also have to say that Sarah has been like her work. Like the first time I saw her work was Penis Nailed to a Board at City Racing in 92, I think. And so, and Knob Soup from that show was just everything. So
yeah. Did you buy work from that show yourself?
No, I don't. I didn't have enough money. But I think the first work I bought from Sarah was from the shop, is that 94?
Yeah, I think.
Three. And that was they closed the shop. I mean, I bought little bits from the shop, but there was a huge brown paper and color copy portrait of Sarah in her boots and her jacket.
Oh, amazing.
Striking the male pose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had closed the shop and had an outstanding what used to be called the poll tax bill. And she said, if you can pay this bill, I'll give, you know, you can have the poster. So that was the first work by Sarah I bought. So that's maybe actually my favourite.
Wow. Do you still live with that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's so amazing.
It's actually in the new museum show that just
is it? Oh, great! What did you think of that show?
I mean,
how do you feel?
Oh,
what pride
God.
You feel for that? Yeah,
it was incredible, very moving to see the whole range of Sarah's language and how it's developed, and how genuine it stayed, how authentic. And I thought the Massimiliano, Joni and Margot Norton, the curators, did a brilliant job of articulating particular moments so that you really understood the whole 30 years.
Mm.
But it was wonderful.
And was that her first museum show in the States? Or her first major one?
Because
I actually found that quite surprising when I heard that. Because I was there in December.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously when you're walking on the street, you saw the giant
boots.
Sculpture in the front. That was quite clever as well. But I remember thinking how interesting it is, this idea that in England, she's just such a kind of god in a way of like contemporary art.
Yeah.
But then in America, that was her first show. And it's almost like you still have to keep building the whole time somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find that exciting, though. I find it's cool.
But that's also the specialness of Sarah. She's not someone who said yes to every opportunity ever.
Right.
She lives her life the way she wants to live her life.
Love
and
that.
She does it for her own to suit herself. She's not thinking, oh, yeah, I'll say yes to this museum show or that museum show. And actually, Massimiliano had pursued Sarah for like 5 years to do that show, and she kept saying no.
Wow.
So, and I believe that she has, the work is as good as it is because she's stuck to her path.
Yeah.
So resolutely.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, that's probably the only way she can be, you know, because she's an artist and, you know.
What's the audience reaction been to it over there?
Amazing.
Has it?
Yeah, I mean.
Critically
she,
and.
Yeah, I think she totally felt the love. That
really?
Was really, really good.
Wow.
I mean, there's a wonderful piece in the New York Times by Roberta Smith, which was like a fangirl letter.
Oh,
it was
wow.
really
so good.
Beautiful. And the show goes on to the Hammer in Los Angeles. And I think Sarah's a real artist. So people just want to see the work. So there were so many artists going and writing to us and saying, you know, this is my dream come true.
But also a lot of my collectors in London or in Europe have all flown out to see that show. Like Paul and Raymond went the other day.
Yeah.
Like people just go for the weekend just to see that show. Like that's the purpose of their trip.
It's a destination.
And I think that says it all. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I'm so happy I saw it because it was a very special show. And weirdly, in your gallery, I came to an opening recently and you had the viewing room and I was with Pauline, who we love
we
as well.
We love Pauline.
We love Pauline.
We
were going to mention that.
Yeah.
We also think it's a really good sign when people can have people in their team who stay for decades. I think that's also a great
How long have you worked with Pauline?
Sign.
A long time because she was an artist and she curated a show. I can't remember what it was called now.
What's her role at your gallery, by the way?
She's the director.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. But she was an artist. She went to the Slade and she curated a show with her then boyfriend on the King's Road in, I think, Max Wickram's space.
Wow.
Remember he had that funny space? You don't know.
I didn't know that. That's before my time.
But and I went to the show and then I saw her working on a Saturday in Phoenix on Bond Street in the Nicole Fari section. And I said, what are you doing here? Because I was working at Doffey's. I was like, what are you doing here? And she was like, well, I have to work.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, I'll get you a job at Doffey's.
Wow.
So I did. So we've actually known each other for,
I didn't know
for
that.
A long, long time. And then when I left Doffey's, I said, just
come with me.
No, because I was going to work for Jeff Koons.
Oh,
I
yeah.
said, just I'll let you know if I do anything. And then I called her up and said, I'm going to open a gallery. Do you want to come and work?
Yeah. So she took me into your viewing room anyway. And that work with the lips, it was on the wall with a cigarette.
Yeah,
I think it's like wax. Is it wax?
Yeah.
That work, I mean, it's so small.
Where does it all end? That's called.
It just has that is such a powerful piece.
Yeah, it's an amazing.
And Carl and I were chatting the other day about the scale of work back then and the fact that these small works just had so much power.
Mm.
And you know when people make giant work suddenly and then you're just like, what does that mean now? But
well,
there's something about
those
early days with all the kind of intimacy.
It's more intimate,
I mean, Sarah so continues good. To make work on a very intimate scale because she
well,
has...
Well, even the Nuds, aren't they?
Yeah, she has no studio, she has no assistant.
So good.
So she does everything on her kitchen table and so everything has that intimacy. I mean, she has made large scale... works like the boots at
was that made for the show?
But that was made for the show. Yeah. So that's really about taking on space and being ambitious about a museum show. Yeah. You know, it's not that she's suddenly got like 20 assistants and is.
No.
I mean,
she obviously has to bulk buy tights as well.
Actually, tights are a real issue because because they're sort of changing, and Sarah likes the old school. So when we go places to like funny places like Mexico or somewhere, she's in heaven because you can, or India, you can find really good tights.
Lingerie from the 80s.
Yeah, right. Or 70s or something.
Wow.
One more question we ask every guest, it's compulsory, is what is your favourite colour? And it can be anything that comes into your mind.
Well, it's funny you're talking about your jumper because it's actually orange.
Is it really?
I have a lot of orange in my house.
Do you?
Yeah.
A lot of furniture and like accessories? Or
I have carpets and things.
Got an
like
orange carpet?
Mm-hmm. I love orange.
In what room?
I find in my living room.
Burnt orange, like...
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I find it a very, very positive colour. I think you're right.
Well, to be really honest, this is kind of a hilarious story, but I grew up with the children of Uri Geller, the guy that bends spoons. He was really famous in the 70s.
Yeah, and, he collected art.
He did, and he actually
did he
knew...
from you?
No.
Oh.
He did come in the gallery once for a John Curran show, though.
Oh, did
in
he?
Fact, I think he might have owned John Curran's work.
Maybe,
but not for me.
He knew Dali and all kinds of people, and... had like proper conversations with him. They were
that would
fascinated.
Make sense. So they were
well, yeah, because he'd bent spoons. Yeah. And I think there's even paintings that Dali made that were influenced by his time with... Geller's actually kind of amazing in the 70s. It was an interesting time. But anyway, when I was growing up, he constantly said to me, orange. Orange is the colour. And he would always say to me, and he'd be like, Rob, hi, Uri. He was super intense. And we're just back in touch with each other recently because he lives in Tel Aviv now. And he's opening a museum about himself.
Oh, wow,
so my
amazing.
Childhood memories are like, his spoons spent yeah. all over his car. And he used to bring it into our school and stuff. It was hilarious. And he came to my house once for dinner, a few times for dinner, and he actually bent my christening spoon. And my mum was just like devastated. She was like, that was Rob's christening spoon. And it's now like in the cupboard somewhere on display, like a bent spoon. It's hilarious. I can't believe I just told you that. But yeah. Hi, Uri, if you're listening. Well, Sadie, thank you so much
for coming on.
I did also want to talk about all the younger generation, but we can do that another time because you've got such great artists now, like Helen Martin, Monster Chetwynd, who constantly evolves changes her name. But
Martine Sims.
She's your most recent addition to the roster.
Actually, Alvaro Barrington.
Have you signed? Is that official now?
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Although I have to say, he's already got about 27 galleries.
I know, but that's great, though. Well, I love that.
I collect his work.
He's
and
great.
I've got work from all different places. And he always never wanted to be defined by one gallery, but now officially.
I love that.
But actually, I was talking to somebody in New York about him, a fellow gallerist, and saying you should look at Alvaro. And this person said to me, oh, no, he's such a hustler. He's got all these galleries. And doesn't that bother you? And I said, actually, I like the fact that he's rethinking the way things can be.
Me too.
It's so boring if we just stay in the Castelli model forever. Mm. And my feeling is that things are healthy if they're evolving. You know, the art market shouldn't stay the same. The way of representing people shouldn't stay the same. The role of a gallerist shouldn't stay. You know, it should be organically evolving all the time. Otherwise, what are we doing here?
I remember you went and met Carl and he told you about Margate and you were one of the first people he told and you were so supportive and open to it and he came back really like, you know, happy
energized
about that meeting. Yeah. And other people just do not get it. And then suddenly now they're getting it. You know what I mean? Like suddenly they're starting to see the finished building. They've come down. It all starts to click
in place. Sadie has no interest in Margate.
But thank you.
She's already made up her mind.
Well, I'm sure it's gorgeous, but it's just that, I mean, I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
I really do, because I think it'll present great opportunities to artists to do something exciting. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to provide an interesting space for great art to be.
I feel
like it would have a biennial or I know there's a Folkestone triennial, but there would be something in Margate at some point that will be like,
well, we've got
survey.
The Turner Prize this September and we're doing an amazing curated show.
Yeah, but you know what, I think we should all go a bit more pagan. I think you should do a festival.
Oh, good one.
So not like
a
pagan
festival.
There should be a procession, possibly with Monster Chetwynd.
Yes.
There should be some late night cult stuff.
I've actually got photos.
Yeah, well, let's do it.
I think that's what you need.
I've got photos of old processions in Margate.
No,
that would
because
be quite genius.
In English coastal towns, there's a lot of really weird ritualistic.
Totally. Well, even the Shell Grotto in Margate is totally weird.
And
they have like seances in there and stuff.
I mean, some of it's a little dodgy, but you should do an art one, which would be, then everyone would come for the weekend.
Oh, that would be
sound
so
like
cool.
Fun.
Yeah. Love that.
Done. Well, we're just going to organise that now then.
We are. And on that note, thank you so much, Sadie.
Yeah, this has been lovely. Thank you very, very much, Sadie.
Good. Nice to see you both.
And everybody listening, please visit our Instagram and you can see images of all the artworks we've been discussing in this episode, and we'll be back very soon.
Love you. Bye.
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 You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Recorded at Spiritland London by Anthony Shaw and edited by Gareth Isles. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.